Now, we'll take each of these 7 points in turn and try to explore each one of them very, very briefly. We're really looking at an area here of our work which rightly requires, I would have thought, a term of practical study. I know it's an area not dealt with in the colleges, but do you know, I have had this view for about 20 years now that practical theology can only be taught in the colleges up to a certain point. It's like boxing. I mean, how much boxing can you learn in a classroom? I mean, you really only learn to begin to box when you get into the ring. And I mean, I know we've got assistantships, but the buck doesn't stop with the assistant. And I think personally that practical theology has got to be an ongoing thing for at least the first 5 or 6 years of the Christian ministry, if not 10 years. And to be perfectly honest, that's where I think Rutherford House is going to try and fill a gap. Okay. The minister as leader. Now, we're going to do an exercise, and it's exercise one, and I don't want you to write on that piece of paper at all, because you'll have to do it away from here. You'll have to do it at home. But we're going to go over it just now, and I'm going to try and explain what each of the various points mean. The reason why you have to do it at home is this, that you have to get someone else to do it. Now, you can take a note of each one, awareness of the feelings of others and what number you think you are, and then you've got to go to a friend, a close friend who knows you well and who works with you in the church, and you've got to tremblingly hand this to him or her and say, "Friend, the wounds of a friend are faithful. Will you tell me what you think about me?" And then you go away into your study when you get his answer and you kneel down and you put it in front of your own, and where his point, his marking of a number is 2 points more than yours, you pray quite a lot about it. Do you get the idea? So, awareness of the feelings of others. Now, I thought that I scored reasonably high on this until about 6 years ago, through a most unfortunate and tragic circumstance, I discovered a man of about 40 in my congregation was very troubled and grappling with the problem of homosexuality. Now, he was a key member of the fellowship in Hamilton Road, and I hadn't a clue. And I think he'd tried to tell me a couple of times, and I didn't pick it up. And I think another man, an elder in Hamilton Road, who twice threw out a lifeline to me, and I didn't even try and grab it. I missed it. Do you know why I missed it? I thought too highly of him. He was a leading member of the congregation. We have to learn a sensitivity. We'll come on to this in listening and communicating. So, don't assume that you do know people's feelings. We've got to learn to read and to look for the way eyes react and pupils dilate and contract and read the body language and see when others are just offering us a little chink in the door and they're asking for us to knock and come and be with them. Willingness to confront people. Now, this is not confrontation in the sense of having a row. This is going to your organist and saying, "Could you speed up a bit?" And you say it very gently. And or it's going to your Sunday school superintendent and in a friendly way saying what you feel and talking about it and listening. So the word confront there is not having a big confrontation. That comes later on under the word conflict. Control of relationships. What it means really is as the minister of Inverclachan with Clachanold, are you willing to settle down in a group and be there and not feel irritation at the way someone else is convening the meeting? And you're not in knots inside, you're inwardly patient, and you're delighted that this man or woman is having a stab at it. You're not always wanting to be in the driving seat yourself. Willingness to change. Well, I don't think that needs very much comment. Tolerance of uncertainty. Self-confidence, how others see me. Ability to listen, we'll look at that. Openness about feelings. Attitude to conflict. Now, the conflict there is the confrontation. I remember, if he doesn't mind me quoting him again, I'd just been at New Hills about 3 months, and I sent very proudly a copy of my first church newsletter to Mr. Still, and he sent it back to me with a letter by return saying, "This is a dreadful thing you've written, the night of blackness and sin in the homes of Bucksburn. What will these people think you think of them?" And then he said something in the letter to this effect: you've got to avoid confrontation as long as you possibly can. Ultimately it will come. And he was using the word confrontation in that letter as I'm using it here. Conflict. So that's something you've got to do with someone else. But now the other one, exercise two, which is on the other side, you can do that just now, and we'll give you about 6 or 7 minutes to give yourself a score there. Don't look down at the score, just tick A, B, or C. Two. Yes, it's in between the two. It's just a choice of words. I mean, in number six, extensive means that you really make a friend of the person. Superficial is, you say, had a good day at work. Where are you going on holiday? Family all well. Or very limited, it's just a nod, good morning. I've got 10 guidelines for the leader. Are you ready for that? There is a sheet for those who can see the screen. Ian Murray made this first point when we were having lunch and we were talking about people management, and he wanted to know what I was going to say, and he said, "I think the first thing about a leader is the leader has to know himself or herself." And I said, well, that's my first point. We have to know ourselves. We have to be completely honest about our weaknesses. And if you think about it, was that not an important point of the Lord's temptations? If you are the Son of God, if you are the Son of God, twice over. And the Lord had to establish his identity as the Son of God. And the Holy Spirit and the Father established it for him at his baptism. God confirmed who he was. And the descent of the Holy Spirit surely was a massive confirmation and assurance for the Lord. Can we say that? I think we can. And surely the whole of his work in our lives is to enable us to come to terms with ourselves, to be completely honest about ourselves. Repentance and sanctification and regeneration, all these have as an integral factor in them the necessity of our being dead honest with ourselves about ourselves. So leaders must know themselves. If we don't know ourselves, and if we're not honest with ourselves about ourselves, however will we be able to counsel or pastor others? If there are large areas of our personalities that have never been sorted out by the Lord and brought to be drenched in his cleansing power and transforming grace, then I'll make a fair guess that our pastoral care of our people will have the most serious blind spots, and we'll misjudge them, we'll wrongly assess their needs, and we'll counsel them in unhelpful ways. We must begin with ourselves. I was in the swimming pool yesterday afternoon and in that jacuzzi, and honestly, I'm not as pious as this normally. I really am not. But I had this thought that the fountain of Christ's cleansing must be a million times more enjoyable and exhilarating than that old jacuzzi. Can you identify with that, those of you who've been in it? It's just the right temperature, the Lord's cleansing. And it's so sublime. And we've got to expose all of our lives to his forgiveness and his cleansing. We must begin with ourselves. Paul describes his pastoral relationship in 1 Thessalonians 2. He says he's like a mother. We were gentle among you, like a mother caring for her little children. You know the verse, I'm sure. He says we were like a father. You know how we dealt with each one of you as a father deals with his own children, encouraging, comforting, and urging you, and like a brother. Four times in the chapter he calls them brothers. There's a sermon for you, like a mother, like a father, like a brother. I'm sure you've already preached it. Then secondly, control yourselves. Now we mustn't misuse our authority. Heavy-handed authority will never win others to be partners in the Lord's work. We can brow people into submission, but we'll never browbeat them into cooperation. And you may have a lovely submissive Kirk session, but don't fool yourselves into thinking that all you suggest they think is wonderful. They may be only going along with you because you bully them. And that isn't leadership. So we must control ourselves. We must also, thirdly, submit ourselves. This is a point George Philip on one occasion in the past made very clearly to me. We must work according to the law of the church and moderate the Kirk session according to the clear guidelines of church law. For example, the moderator may not propose motions to the session, but can only encourage or elicit motions, and there's a certain skill in doing that. So in our chairmanship, we have to demonstrate our own submission to the authority of the church's laws. Fourthly, in the appointment of other leaders. Now, this is a subject all on its own. Remember, the Lord spent the night in prayer before appointing the apostles. So prayerfully and with care, we invite others to serve. And remember the Lord's words to Simon, you will be. Choose leaders in the faith of what they will become. Now that's hard. And I've known an awful lot of evangelicals who wouldn't give anyone in a congregation a position of responsibility until they could say, I'm saved. I think that's a very weak doctrine of the visible church. That's a controversial statement. We have to use our people. I mean, what on earth is Chuck McVicar going to do in Inverclachan if he doesn't give anyone anything to do until they're saved? The whole thing grinds to a standstill, doesn't it? And then fifthly, we have to be dead honest with people when we make appointments. Don't underplay the problems. Don't underplay the cost or the demands that this task is going to make. Remember the clarity and the transparent honesty of the Lord's call to us when he calls us to follow him. And then Sixthly, spend time with your leaders. Study the time the Lord's ministry allocated to his apostles on the one hand and to the public on the other. I think if we try to model our ministries on the Lord Jesus, many of us will have to admit that our elders and our leaders really get shortchanged from us. He spent time relaxing with them. Have you ever relaxed with your elders? To get to know them. He spent time intensively teaching just the elders. So spend time with your leaders. I reckoned at Hamilton Road I had to spend 20% of my time with my pastoral team. Then face up to problems. I think sometimes we can duck difficult issues and sweep them under the carpet. We have to help our elders and our committee members to face up to and even anticipate likely problems. When your elders are prepared for problems, then they will have confidence in your leadership. Give commendation and praise. Now, speak to Frank Seller, who was with me for 4 years, and he will say, this is where David Searle falls down terribly. I have never given enough praise and commendation, I admit that. I need to learn to do that more. Isn't it? The psychologists call it giving positive strokes. You see, some of our elders may feel very inadequate. They may have a view of you from your preaching which is totally unrealistic. So learn to smile with them and smile at them and relax with them and give them warm, friendly encouragement. Be their friend. You see, we inherit our predecessors' relationship with the congregation. And I followed one particular minister who had the motto for his relationship with his Kirk Session to keep them all at arm's length and give them all the right hand of fellowship. And you know, it took me 8 years to break that down. They wanted me up on a pedestal. And I wanted to be friends with them, genuinely friends, as a brother, as an equal. That doesn't prejudice our leadership. And 9, expect your elders to grow spiritually and help them to grow by helping them to learn. Now, we mustn't pose as the expert 6 feet above contradiction. We must enable them to stand alongside us as equals growing together. I think there is a genuine blockage in people's understanding of sanctification because many ministers allow themselves to be thought of by their congregations as Christians who have arrived and have no problems. I think that's a particular fault, more so in Ireland than in Scotland. Now, my Irish brethren may want to disagree with me, but the Irish love to have their minister up there, you know. And as a result, they seem to think that there is something that can happen to your life and all of a sudden you become the perfect person. And I shocked my folk in Hamilton Road many a time by telling them that I was a sinner like them and had temptations and made a mess and made mistakes. And it's essential to their understanding of sanctification to know that we are flesh and blood just the same as them. And it's also essential to a good relationship with them and to making friends with them. So expect them to grow spiritually and don't pose as someone whom we are not. And 10, give your session and all your committees clear objectives. Now, I know you've got your own personal agenda. You've got these aims, and that's between you and God, you see. You don't share that necessarily with them. You've got your hidden agenda, which is between you and your God. But formulate annual or two-yearly objectives for the session, or for the Sunday school, or for your Bible class leaders. Set targets which are attainable, but which will stretch them and demand faith and prayer. A good leader will make sure that his team knows where they're going. Those are 10 guidelines for a leader. Now, leadership styles. And we're on to this little thing that you've got, this sheet that you've got, the Tannenbaum and Schmidt. Have you all got that? Now, which mode was Sandy operating in yesterday when he was trying to fix the dates next January? He was acting as our leader in arranging the January CREEF conference. Someone said six. Five. Well, it was five or four, wasn't it? But tell me, in your Kirk session, which of these modes, which is the right one? The minister of St. Columbus Kilmacombe operates in number one. Which is the right one? Well, will you listen? Will you listen? Authoritarian. Now, broadly speaking, there are three main styles of leadership: the authoritarian, the democratic, and in between these two, the laid back. And the minister's style of leadership is going to depend on various factors, some of which might be, for the authoritarian, it might be your personality. You're a self-confident extrovert. It may be that you mistrust your elders and you're frightened of their opposition, and so your reaction to that is by being authoritarian. It may be that you're very sensitive to your status. I mean, you've got this dog collar around your neck, and it's known in the adverts as the ring of confidence from Colgate. And you desire to protect your ministerial authority. You are God's appointed man, and let them never forget that. It may be that it's your belief that it's the minister's prerogative to make the decisions, and the elders are really there to say, yes, sir. It may be that you've got messianic complex one. That is, that the minister is divinely appointed. I call it the John Paul II complex. And I honestly think that we've got a fair touch of popery in the Church of Scotland. It may be that you've got messianic complex too, that the minister's ideas are divinely inspired. Go on to the democratic. Now, you may be democratic because you're an introvert, or it may be that you lack self-confidence. You've got a feeling of inadequacy. You don't know what to do, so you say, what should we do? And you pose behind the front of being a democrat. You've got to decide. But really, it's that you haven't a clue where you're going. Lack of clarity about your aims, your objectives, your strategy. Or it may be that you're a ditherer and you're unwilling or unable to make decisions, or you haven't the courage to make a decision. That's why you're democratic. Maybe that you're frightened of being unpopular, and so you hide behind a cloak of being democratic. Or it may be that you're plain incompetent and inconsistent. Well, now, there are advantages and disadvantages both ways. For example, authoritarian leaders tend to neglect the brain power potential of their Kirk session and use only their personal brain power and ideas, and so suppress the gifts which both the Bible and experience tell us the elders will have. They'll also become increasingly isolated from their elders and even feared by some of them. I know some elders who are genuinely frightened of their minister. And certainly the morale of the session runs very low, and the genuine involvement in the work can decrease. On the other hand, democratic leaders run the risk of a dominant elder taking over the session. They run the risk of losing the trust and respect of their elders, who find their minister annoyingly reluctant to make decisions. the lack of trust and respect within the Kirk session is then carried over into the congregation, and members of the session begin to think more of their own personal needs than of the needs of the congregation, and the commitment of the elder falls, as does the standard of the work. So which of these modes is right? The answer is surely obvious. It can never be good leadership always to operate in mode 1. Neither can it be good leadership always to operate in mode 7. The secret of leadership is to know which of the 7 modes to adopt in any given situation. The competent leader will easily move from one mode to another. On occasions, the leader will know that he must be in mode 1. This is what we're going to do. I'm sorry, there's no discussion. This is it. And people will respect that. On the other hand, there are certain things, such as the date next January, where one has to operate in mode 4 or 5 to keep a consensus. So we have to be conscious of this. Now, I say again that older people in the ministry, they'll know this just instinctively. You learn it as you go along. But some of you younger men, it's good to have it formulated for you in this way and realize that you've got to be flexible and able to assess the situation and realize what style of leadership to adopt in any given situation. Yes, do you want to comment?
When the Lord reveals to you something that has to be done, that's from Him, and it has to be done, but you've got to sell it to your congregation, and that may take some time. The first time I announced from the pulpit that we were going to remove all the pews and put in movable chairs, but it took a year or two before we got it done.
That's right, yes, yes. Oh, indeed. Well, change takes time. Can we move on then to motivation? Now, I'm quite sure that many of the problems weighing down congregations today, among the many problems weighing down congregations today, lack of motivation ranks very high. Recently, since I ceased to be a minister in a charge, I've been attending many different congregations, and you know, it's made my heart heavy to see the lack of motivation, particularly among elders and office bearers. There's often no sense of anticipation in the services. One meets dull resignation and an expectation of continuing discouragement and falling statistics. No wonder so many churches are in difficulties and going down. Now, why such an evident lack of motivation among so many? Well, I know there are many factors, and I'm going to put my head on the chopping block and say that I think, and I may be quite out of place, but I think that one is the punitive financial assessments that so many congregations face from 1 to 1. The burden of financial demands from the central offices of the church is certainly having a most negative effect on the motivation of many elders and office bearers. And I say that because when I left Larbert Old and went to Hamilton Road, and the Irish chaps here will think that they have punitive assessments as well, let me tell you this. The income of Larbert Old in 1985 was in round figures 55,000. When I went to Hamilton Road the same year, 85, its income was about 100,000. Do you know that 121 wanted more from Larbert Old than Church House wanted from Hamilton Road? Just take that in. And Hamilton Road was sitting uncomfortably on what they were being asked for. Jim Phillip told me the other day that it takes, I'm sure he won't mind me saying this, I haven't got his permission to say it, that it takes from the 1st of January to the 30th of September to pay all the dues to 121 George Street, and Holyrood has to exist on what comes in from the 1st of October to the 31st of December. And you see, the more your income goes up, the more they want. Now, I know that the Christian attitude is to pay without grumbling. But can I say that those in the committee hierarchy really should try and see if over a period of 2 or 3 years they couldn't try and begin to see mission and service reduced by 20, 30, 40%. I think there's enormous discouragement and there's not really enough money to do the job at the grassroots level. Personally, now that might be out of place. But I'm convinced that at the end of the day, the motivation of our people is the work of the minister and no one else. If we cannot motivate them, then humanly speaking, no one else can. Unless there's strong, powerful motivation, we'll never get the best out of our people in terms of Christian service. And I want to offer you four elements in motivation. And the first is inspiration. Motivation comes first and foremost when God's people are inspired. And where are they going to be inspired? By our pulpit ministry. And let me say just three things about preaching that may have a bearing on inspiration. First, the preacher's own heart must be set on fire by the Holy Spirit as he takes up the living truth of God. The truth of God and the Holy Spirit must somehow intertwine. The Holy Spirit on fire in us, and so God's truth on fire. Preaching is theology on fire. I think the unpardonable sin of the pulpit is to be boring. That really is unpardonable. And if you're boring in the pulpit, then really pray that God will deliver you and light a fire in your heart, kindle a flame of sacred love on the mean altar of your heart. And then, I've said this already, I say it again, the preacher must always move from the then and there of the Bible to the here and now of today. I've heard so many sermons during which the preacher began in the 6th century BC and stayed there from start to finish. And with all respect, I don't think that's preaching. If we stay in the then and there of the Bible, we're lecturing. We're not preaching. And thirdly, the preacher must major on the grace and compassion and goodness and tenderness and love and mercy of the Lord our God. It's this good news. Now, I mentioned at Larbertold that I tended to hammer them in the first 6 years, and it was necessary. I was going to tell you some of the sins in the session, but I think I'd better not. But they were dreadful sins. My own family often poke fun at me and tell me that the great message which comes through in my preaching is the exceeding sinfulness of sin. They say, oh, that's Dad again. But oh, the grace and love and mercy of God in Jesus Christ must excite and exhilarate us. And when it does, then our hearts are aflame. And we bring grace into the here and now. And then people will be inspired. So inspiration is the first element in motivation. The second is the theology of the body of Christ. Have you read Calvin on Ephesians 4? The Apostle Paul writes, "But to each one of us, grace has been given as Christ has apportioned it." And Calvin's comment is this: this verse may be summed up thus, "On no one has God bestowed all things, but each has received a certain measure, so that we need one another, and by bringing together what is given to them individually, they help one another." That's the end of the quote from Calvin. Clearly, the work of Christ was never intended to be accomplished by one person in each congregation. We need each other. To quote Paul again, the eyes need the ears, the hands need the feet. To each one who is born of God, a gift is given by Christ. Do we believe that? To each one born of God, a gift is given by Christ. To each one of us, grace has been given as Christ apportioned it. So each one has a task to do for the Master, and our members will be motivated when the Holy Spirit presses upon them their responsibility in the Church of God, and that he equips them to do the task. Then responsibilities in the Lord's work. Here is one of the most important pastoral tasks ministers have to do. It lies with the minister to know our people well enough to be able to fill each vacant position in the congregational job center with the right person. Now, some of you may disagree with me, but I've always seen myself in my 32 years in the ministry, I've always seen myself as really having the responsibility of assigning the work. Now, you may want to delegate that, but I said to my boys' brigade captain when he approached someone to be a BB officer, don't do that until you've spoken to me. Is that wrong? I feel that everything should go in this particular area. Personally, I feel it should go through the minister. And then when we ask someone to undertake some service, we must make it absolutely clear what responsibility we're committing to them. Will you laugh when I tell you that the Sunday school superintendent of Hamilton Road had a full job description approved by the Kirk Session? His responsibilities were clearly defined. Often time scale has to be included in the definition. It should be made clear not only exactly what needs to be done, but by when it should be done. Motivation requires this third element of well-defined responsibilities. And then appraisal and encouragement. Here it is again. There must be continuing guidance, support, and encouragement. It's not as enough, as we shall see when we look at delegation, to give someone a task and then just leave them to it. We must support them. And that will mean taking time to talk about what they're doing, offering counsel, listening to problems they may be encountering, giving fresh direction, and so fresh encouragement. These four elements of inspiration, theology of the church, allocating responsibilities, appraisal and encouragement can be set out as you see on the overhead projector. And they interact. There's a circle, continuous circle, going round all the time. Now, delegation. Now, delegation isn't as simple as it may sound. I recall an assistant minister, I was a student with him at St. Andrews, and he discovered that the church where he was working, the minister had handed out to various people more or less all the work, and it had left him little to do, and they were working into the small hours, and he was cruising round congratulating himself on getting away with about a 25-hour week. And I remember this particular guy, he ultimately never ended up in a church, but he had a confrontation with his bishop about this and told him how wrong he thought it was. Now, he was right in his assessment, but I don't think he was right in the way he tackled it. The congregation of that man was steadily running down. But you see, the truth was that he hadn't delegated at all, but was using the authority of his clerical collar to dump his work on others. And delegating is not dumping. The two are not the same. So here are 9 rules for delegation. Now again, we could spend a working session on this and discuss it, but here they are very quickly. 1, provide a full description of the work you're asking someone to undertake. There shouldn't be any uncertainty in someone's mind as to the boundaries within which they're being asked to work. When you delegate, make it clear what you're asking them to do. 2, make sure your leader or your helper understands what you're asking them to do by going over the description of the work and answering questions. Don't just hand them it and say, that's it. I remember I did that with someone, and he phoned me up and said, could I see you? And he'd drawn up about 4 sheets of questions about the job description that I had given him, the job I'd asked him to do, and I had to spend about an hour explaining it, and I realized what a mistake I'd made in assuming that he knew what I meant. So, go over it. And then 3, don't anticipate the answers your helpers may have to find, but make sure they know where to look for the answers. For example, resource people they may have to contact. Say, well, now, when you're doing this, it would be best to speak to so-and-so. Or go and speak to her. She'll be able to help you on that. Give them some positive direction and help. 4, don't take away responsibility from your helpers by making the necessary decisions yourself. Now, I know a minister well, and he makes all the decisions himself, even when he's delegated. and I think it's a mistake. Allow as much scope as you can to encourage your helpers to rise to the challenge you've given them. And then fifthly, be gentle and cautious about correcting mistakes they make. Of course they'll make mistakes. But we make mistakes, don't we? Or are we infallible? Six, give ongoing support and encouragement after you've delegated. Don't abandon your helper, but say, now look, I'll speak to you in a fortnight. Or come and see me in 2 weeks' time and let me know how you're getting on and we'll discuss it. You must give ongoing support. You must keep your finger on the pulse. You must keep in touch. Seven, try to forestall your helpers coming back to you unnecessarily over small decisions you want them to take. You know, you give your elder a district to look after, and Granny Barnes stubs her toe against the fender, and they come and tell you. I mean, what do you want me to do about it? She's stubbed her toe against the fender. Go and see her. And if she needs a prayer over her toe, you pray it. Do you know what I'm saying? Number eight, if one of your helpers makes a wrong decision, don't correct it in public. Correct it privately. Don't cause embarrassment to someone that you've entrusted with work. And finally, never lay blame on someone to whom you've delegated the responsibility. The buck stops with you for all delegated work. I hope this isn't getting too boring. I feel that I'm throwing so much at you. The next one is enabling our Kirk Session and Congregational Board. Now, we had new halls built in my last congregation, and they're lovely halls. And one might think, seeing them, that my Congregational Board in Ireland, it's called Congregational Committee, needed no enabling whatsoever. Can I tell you that I never attended the Congregational Board? Twice a year only. I chaired it for the first 4 years, and then I said, over to you. And they got on with it, and I looked in twice a year, maybe three times. But in November 1992, I put a request into the board for coat pegs to be installed in the main vestibule of the new hall. Now, you say, that was silly, not putting them there. There was a perfectly good reason why they weren't installed there, and I'll not bore you with it. Those coat pegs were on the agenda of the board at every meeting for 12 months. And I phoned someone in the church to find out if the job had been done. And yes, it was done just at the end of November 1993. Do you know the problem? Translating decisions into action. Is that a problem? We call it enabling. And my guess is that we've all chaired meetings where decisions have been made and months later no action has been taken to implement those decisions. We have to learn how to make decisions effective. Now, this is really a very, very inadequate and quick outline on chairmanship. There are three basic skills we must identify in order to chair a Kirk Session or any committee effectively. And the first is definition. This is perhaps the most basic skill that those in the chair must master. We must be able to define clearly where the Kirk Session or the committee needs to go, where it wants to go, and where it is ready to go. Those three aren't the same. Those who are in the chair must be able to sum up accurately the needs, the desires, and the readiness of the group, the Kirk Session. We must have in our own minds certain questions if we're going to be competent chairmen. And we must see that these questions are asked and answered. For example, where are we trying to go? What are we trying to do? What should be done first? And then next? And what can wait? And why? In other words, what is the priority here? And what is this going to cost? And where will the money come from? It's those who are in the chair. It's our responsibility to define clearly the action needed. But having given the targets, clear definition, and answered the questions where, why, which, what, it's necessary then for the chairman to arrange a new set of questions to be answered, which ask how. Take a very simple example. Someone on the session suggests we have a children's holiday club. You say that's a great idea. Kirk Session discuss it. They agree it should be done. They appoint two elders, both are Sunday school teachers, to implement this decision. You take it to your board and they vote generously £100 towards the cost for the first year. Now the question is how? And it will be necessary to gather together a group of interested members to put in some work to answer that question. You'll want those with gifts and a burden for working with children. You'll want creative thinkers with good ideas. You'll want down-to-earth people with highly critical faculties. And you'll want a number of people who are willing to get their hands dirty. But this house stage is often neglected, and too many ministers are left to implement the session's decision on their own. The number of times I failed to direct a decision of the session onto a group to implement it, and I've been left, or my session clerk, holding the baby. We haven't learned to mobilize people to move from definition to implementation, or else because they foolishly think we're the only ones able to do the work, and there are ministers about like that. Then implementing the decisions is the second skill. The first is defining, the second is implementing. The chairman must have confidence in certain elders or board members to agree the decision, or should their numbers be strengthened or a new group appointed? And having decided on the necessary implementation team, he must now ascertain they understand what requires to be done, they have a date by which the various stages of the work should be done, and each stage of the work should be checked lest there's a neglected link in the chain. Ongoing review. 3. After decisions have been implemented, it's important to have post-mortems. Have an agenda, an item on the agenda, whether it's the session or the planning group, to ask whether the work done could have been done more swiftly, more efficiently, more economically. Now, to come back to the example of a children's holiday club in Larbert, we always completed the whole process with a review of the full planning program, which ran from April to August, and we went over each stage, plus the 10 days program, asking critical questions, all with a view to improving next year's holiday club. And we made this final session something of a social occasion, and members of the holiday club team brought an item of food along so we could finish with supper and fellowship. And that principle needs to be applied in different ways to every working committee we have. The session or board or group of Sunday school teachers must learn the discipline of review. They should keep records of their review meetings so that when next year's Christmas parties, for example, come round, they're able to check on what we agreed, the mistakes we made this year or the last year, and what could be done better or differently or more economically. And built into this whole process of enabling must be motivation and fellowship and commitment. Without that spiritual motivation, loving fellowship, and a full commitment to the Lord and his work, our enabling will really grind to a standstill. Now, how good are you at listening? Sit back, and I hope you've got the two sheets on that, 20 questions, and I'll tell you how to score in about 5 or 6 minutes' time. People, one of the most fundamental principles is that we learn to be good listeners. Some are good listeners naturally. I would say I'm not. So we have to discipline and train ourselves to listen with attention, with sympathy, and with empathy. And as we listen, we have to learn to read the body language of the person speaking and to pick up their hesitations, their nervousness, their resentment, their fear, their mistrust, their other emotions, often carefully concealed. I don't want to embarrass him, but I think the best listener I have ever known is William Still. Those of you who have spent time with him, he does all this. He squeezes out of you things that you went along resolve not to tell him. Have you ever had that experience? You do. You said you were coming to laugh. I said you'd stay to pray. Have you ever recognized in yourself one of the most common stumbling blocks to good listening? Now, listen to this. The person speaking begins with a few words in which he expresses partial agreement with your policy as the minister. And then he slips into voicing disagreement with some aspect of what you're doing. And at once, your level of listening falls as you now begin to think how to answer his objections. So that as the person explains his thinking, your listening level has fallen significantly and you're distracted with your own thoughts as you prepare an answer to his first few sentences. But the kernel of what he's saying you've missed. And as he comes to an end of what he's got to say, you concentrate again, but when you reply, you only address the early comments he made. And you leave out entirely his main problems because your listening at that point was seriously defective. And the result? Real communication breaks down, and it's actually your fault. The matter he wanted to share with you has not been understood. He's failed to communicate with you through your poor listening. And you failed to communicate in reply to him because your response was inadequate because of your poor listening. And therefore there hasn't been full and frank communication on either side, and consequently the relationship is now flawed. Well, you've studied the 20 questions, and I'm going to give you the answers. And I think you should cover your answer with your hands so the person next to you can't see it. If you scored less than 50, then your relationships with your elders and church must be in such bad shape it's surprising you're surviving in the ministry at all. Pardon? Oh, I didn't tell you how to score. Oh dear, that's a... Well, you just add up what you've circled. I mean, if you've circled a 5, that's 5 points. Yes. Agreeing. No, I don't mean, I mean listening to hear. Yes. Oh, no, it's listening to hear. It's listening to hear, definitely. Well, if you've scored less than 50, you're in a bad way, brother, sister. If your score is between 50 and 70, then there could be a fair bit of misunderstanding in your relationships. And if your score is over 70, then be encouraged and try and improve. Pardon?
What about those of us who are listening too much and are not affirmative enough? Because you might be a brilliant listener. You're like a sponge.
Well, let's come on to communication. But I've got, I think I've got some rules, some guidelines here. And it's overhead projector 15 and 16, the first one, and then a second. Yes.
Body language, not so much gestures, smiles, nod. Is so important. The actors teach us this. You see, in a scene where an actor is not involved, his face is registering all that the other actor is saying constantly. Eyes and some people's faces are just flat and they register nothing. That's dreadful.
Going to say something about that under communicating.
Sorry.
No. Right, 13 guidelines for listening. Work hard at being a good listener. Oh, I have to work hard at it. 2, always keep an open and alert mind when listening. Open to what's being said and alert. 3, don't assume that you know what people are going to say. Don't make assumptions. 4, take care not to hear what you yourself want to hear. 5, withhold your evaluation of what is being said until the person's finished talking. 6, you can't help noticing the way a person is speaking to you, but don't allow your own personal prejudices against sex or colour or accent to cause your level of listening to fall. Do you know, I have to confess that I often would be prejudiced against someone by their accent. It's awful, the sin in my heart. I mean, can I whisper that American accents turn me off? Is that bad? You know, I've really got to work at that. You realize what a flawed, fallible fool I am. 7, if you don't quite understand a point being made, then make sure you ask the speaker to explain further. Don't respond on the basis of a partial grasp of what's been said. 8, if your listening level fell because you were distracted for a few moments, then have the honesty to interrupt and say to the speaker, I'm sorry, I didn't grasp that, I missed it. Apologize and be willing to take the blame for your poor listening and get them to repeat it again. 9, don't indulge in the unfortunate habit of finishing people's sentences for them. Isn't that irritating? You could very well have taken up the speaker wrongly, but he or she is too shy to correct you, again resulting in a breakdown of communication. Oh yes, that's different. That is different if you sense they're stumbling for a word and you supply it. 10, don't plan your response to the speaker until he or she has finished. 11, avoid being prejudiced by terms and phrases which the speaker might use, but which you understand in a certain way and believe to mean something with which you intensely disagree. The speaker may not be using those phrases with the same understanding as you happen to have. Now, that's a very subtle point, but an important one. An example. Alistair asks an example of that. It very often happens with theological discussion, you know. And what you understand by the role of women in the church, or what you understand by the word feminism, or even the word evangelical or charismatic. You know, one's got to listen and try and assess what they mean and then say, now, is this what you mean? Because I understand by such and such the word Christian. The word paradigm, I still am not quite sure what paradigm means. 12, while you listen, maintain eye contact. Don't allow your attention to be distracted. Don't gaze at some point in the middle distance. And if your attention is distracted, for example, by a telephone call, then apologize and summarize what you understood has been said so far, and then invite the speaker to take up the story and give full renewed attention to what's being said. And 13, when listening, if there's someone else in the manse, it's best to try and make sure there'll be no interruptions at all, and to get someone else to answer the phone. Yes, I know. I know what you're saying. Can I tell you how I coped with that in not New Hills, but I started it at Larbert and continued it at Hamilton Road? I had someone in the vestibule of the church near me with a notebook and pencil. And when someone began going on about something, I said, look, I don't want to miss people. If there's a visit you want me to do or you want to pass on a message, could you just have a word? And I trained the congregation to do that. But I know that is a very great difficulty. It really is.
Remember that we have five, or little about five, to that particular situation.
I know. I mean, if someone wants to speak to one, I would tend to say, do you mind if I speak to folk just now? Could you wait until the end? And then you can give them their attention, rather than, as you say, see everyone going past and here you are. And very often that kind of person is just blethering, aren't they? That's awful. That shows prejudice. Right, communicating with others, and this is under the same heading, and we're almost finished. Love must be sincere. Romans 12:9. Deacons are to be worthy of respect, sincere. 1 Timothy 3:8. The wisdom that comes from above is first of all pure, then impartial and sincere. And I want to issue a warning. Most of you will know this well enough, but some of you may not have discovered it yet. We convey our lack of sincerity without realizing it, and others pick it up without realizing it either. But in their gut, deep down, they know whether or not we're genuine. We may be smiling. We may have pleasant things to say. We may believe that we're pulling the wool over other people's eyes, but while our facial expressions are being controlled, our eyes are telling another story. As our pupils dilate and contract, subconsciously the other person is picking up a message, and subconsciously it's registering their brains. In other words, we fool no one except ourselves when we're not sincere. And so the great guideline beyond and above all others in verbal communication is sincerity. If we really love our people, we'll not need to tell them. They'll know. And alas, if we don't love them, they'll know. They'll rumble us. Folk of Nadaf. Here are some simple points about communicating with your leaders and with your people. One, make sure you have... These aren't on an overhead transparency, I don't think. Oh, they are. Yes. Right. Make sure you have eye contact, provided that is you're sincere. Look people in the eye. We'll never communicate with them if our eye is fixed on some point in the middle distance. Be willing to stand near to them, without invading their personal space too much. Come in close, but not too close. How close? Three, close enough to be able to lay a hand on their shoulder or arm. Physical touch can be very reassuring as long as it's sincere and wise. Insincere or unwise physical contact will, of course, be counterproductive. Now, here's a little interlude. This fascinated me. An experiment was carried out on the effect of physical contact. Now, I was, as you know, probably some of you, psychiatric chaplain to Belsdyke Mental Hospital for 10 years. And I got this from there. A woman stood near a public telephone in which about £5 in pound coins had been left. And as each person came out of the call box, she hurried up saying, "You didn't find some money in there, did you?" And one after another, about 90% of the persons questioned denied finding the money, though they'd been clearly seen pocketing the £5. And then a new tactic was tried. As the woman hurried to the call box, and this took many hours to do this experiment, and asked about the £5 that she'd left, she put her hand on the arm of the caller. And 90% of those touched returned the money. Dennis Westfield, who was the chief psychiatrist at Belsdyke Mental Hospital, told me that one can skip about 5 stages in a relationship by a gentle hand on the arm, and people will confide in you much more quickly. Amazing thing.
Very important. But there are certain people who absolutely hate touched.
Yes.
And you've got to be very, very careful. And as soon as you see a reaction,
you withdraw.
Absolutely.
That's very helpful. I'll put that into my notes. Then four, stand or sit in a position of attentiveness. My wife used to say to me that when someone was talking to me and the man whom I didn't like, I had a way of retreating into the chair, which conveyed the message, I'm shrinking back from you. And she used to chastise me, as a wife properly should, about that. Be attentive. And sorry? Oh, she's a hard woman, yes. Be attentive and don't give signals of rejection by your posture, which you will do unconsciously if you are rejecting them. Five, use couthy, friendly language. Oh, don't use pompous words and phrases, yet be respectful in your choice of words. Six, make your tone of voice and the volume of your voice as normal as possible. Pious whispers and earnest groans can be very off-putting. I've heard some amazing tones of voices from ministers. It made me wanted to spit or swear, or just shock them into normality. Seven, control, I'm not saying I did spit or swear. Seven, control your facial expressions. Mrs. Still's just spoken about this. You don't have to have a big vacuous smile on your face all the time. On the other hand, neither do you have to have an expression which suggests you've just had bad news about your bank account. React appropriately, and I suppose that only comes when we're relaxed and sincere. Eight, avoid jargon. Oh dear, it's amazing how much evangelical jargon some people pick up and use without thinking. Try your best to be a normal 20th century person, using language any other normal 20th century person will understand. Empathize. Try and put yourself, that is, into the place of the person you're talking to. Try and imagine what it must be like to be in his or her situation. Work hard at understanding the one you're talking with. Deliberately think about how they could be feeling and try to visualize their background and point of view. And finally, and my old principal, who had such a profound effect on me, Ernest F. Kevin, used to say, give time. Never be in a hurry, he used to say to us. And then he'd say this, and I laugh at it now. I don't think we'd say this in a college now. But this was way back in the 1950s. He'd say, a big man is never in a hurry. He'd go on to say that the only time you should be in a hurry is if you're on the way to an appointment or to catch a train or a bus. And then you would lay your hand on their arm and say, look, I'll have to see you another time. I'm sorry. I've got an appointment. And fix a time quickly. That's not to say that we sit and sit and sit and sit. We control every situation firmly, but being in firm control never means we give the impression of being in a hurry. Yes.
When we first started CREEF about 70...
I was just thinking of that,
22
yes,
years 72. Ago with Jeff, it began, we gathered together, you see, for a few months, 1972, wasn't it?
In Sandy's Manch, yes.
Sandy's Manch, to hear Jeff Dixon, who's a psychiatrist elder of ours, who's been in Australia ever since, and we wanted to and we wanted to pick his brains, and that was one of the things he said from a medical point of view, that dealing with patients in a clinical situation, so that you control how long they're permitted to remain with you.
Yes. Now, the last thing, you'll be relieved to know, and perhaps a little disappointed to know, that I'm just going to have to tell you about it. It runs to 5 pages, the test, and it was going to cost about £20 of Rutherford House's money. So I thought what I would say to you, to go through this exercise, I'll get these notes, if you want them, spiral bound, and you can have them for £2, order them from the house, and this last one will be included, so you can do it. And just now, I'm going to tell you about it. Now, before Willie puts that on the screen for me, can I tell you, I found this very, very helpful. I did it with Victor Laidlaw's Kirk session recently, And they seem to find it helpful. And Frank Sello was commenting how helpful he has found it. The way this came about was John F. Kennedy said that he wanted to get a man on the moon in 10 years. That he wanted to appoint a group that would be effective working. And he had noticed in his career, in his time as a politician, that some groups achieved nothing and some groups did achieve. So he set a whole lot of psychologists and experts, and they spent about 4 years analyzing several million miles of videotapes of boardroom meetings and committees at work until they had analyzed the various elements that were necessary in a group for it to be effective. And then a man in Cambridge, Meredith Belbin, who's in charge of the industrial psychology group at Cambridge University, he got these results and he analyzed them himself. He'd been working on exactly the same thing. And the Americans said that 7 different gifts were necessary, and he said, wrong, I found an 8th. And he published it as a book, and I have summarized from that book what he says. Now, the reason why I found it very helpful is that there are definitely different types of personalities, and it helps us enormously in working with people to understand that in a Kirk session, in a discussion, different people subconsciously are fulfilling different roles, and that the role a certain person may be fulfilling, though we may not like it, is a necessary one for an effective and fruitful discussion and decision. Now, we'll just go over these. And the exercise is to find out what particular personality type you have. About 5 minutes, well, the very most.
We must finish in less than 5 minutes.
Right.
Because, tell us, Sandy, television is coming.
Okay. Well, very, very quickly, the plant is the person with the creative ideas. That's the up and down diagonal, which is the thinking. Very few people are actually creative, but most of you will have a plant or a creative person in your session. They are balanced by the monitor evaluator, who is an analytical person, usually a civil servant, who says, ah, but you can't do that because law such and such, paragraph such and such, subsection such and such, says so and so. Very annoying person, but very necessary. Because usually your creative person doesn't have very much judgment. And they have to be valued by the analytical person so that only what is going to work is seriously considered. The horizontal diagonal at the left-hand side is the completer finisher, usually an accountant type, looking at the clock all the time, saying, look, we've got a lot of work to do, we're being distracted, can we get back to the main point? It's 9 o'clock, we've still 3 items on the agenda. Balancing him is the resource investigator, who's the kind of person who's got contacts everywhere. He knows where you can get a chain. He knows where you can get a rope for the tug of war at the Sunday school picnic. He knows a man who, you know, he's always late for a meeting because he's always on the phone. He's always chatting to people, a distinct type, resource investigator. The task orientation, the company worker, he wants to know exactly what we should be doing and who should be doing it. The team worker is the person who is people conscious and notices when someone's been left out or has perhaps been slighted or offended. He's task orientated, but towards people. And the final diagonal, the chairman, who is not necessarily in the chair, has an overview of the whole thing. And he's balanced by the shaper, who is easily the most difficult person to get on with, who sees the whole thing as an extension of his own ego and wants to react and act and get it going. He's usually a compulsive driving force who pushes others on. Now, there's a simple test that you can do. It takes about 15 minutes. And I'll include it in the final notes. And it's very, very useful to be able to recognize certain traits in members of your session. It helps you to understand them and accept them. Finish.